So from where did you fly?
From Raleigh-Durham. I live in Chapel Hill.
Uh-huh. That's the old stomping ground of Alice Adams.
That's right.
She has been on my broadcast a number of times. And
I think I've heard her on your broadcast. I've heard your broadcast a number of times.
Where?
I'm trying to think. I've heard it, I think, in Richmond, Virginia.
Possible.
Yeah, when I visited friends there. And I think I've heard it in North Carolina.
Well,
too.
It has a modest syndication, but very modest. But
is it out of Charlotte at all?
I don't know.
I doubt it, but you may well have listened to that station often. I'm not sure what station it was on.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the book. After I started reading it, I just was able to read a few pages and know that I did indeed want to talk to you, so that when Harriet Blacker said you were available, I was delighted.
You're really nice to do this. This is really nice.
Well, it was certainly a nice introduction to your work. You've been writing for quite a while, though, haven't you?
A long time, 20 years.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you a Virginian?
Yes, I am. I'm from Grundy, Virginia, which is in the heart of the coal country.
Grundy, Virginia?
Grundy, Virginia. It's in Buchanan County, Virginia. It's very close to Kentucky. It's very close to West Virginia. It's very mountainous, rugged, remote, and kind of cut off area where coal mining is the main source of income.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up there?
Well, it was wonderful, actually. It, in many ways, I've realized since it was really very special because we were. I can't describe to you what the mountains are like there. You're geographically very cut off. The mountains are straight up and down. And my mother, who moved there from Chincoteague Island, Virginia, could never get over the fact that the sun doesn't come up until about 11 o'clock, for instance. That is, it'll come up, but it won't hit your yard because the mountains are not beautiful there. They're just very rugged. Mm-hmm. And so I had a sense of, I suppose, great security in a way growing up. I come from a great big family. Although I was an only child, I had a ton of cousins and uncles and aunts and everybody that I grew up among. And you had this sense of sort of enclosure and security and so on. And later on, that can be stifling.
Was your family?
But when you're small, it's wonderful. It's really nice.
Was your family involved in coal mining?
No, they were not. My daddy has a dime store.
Oh.
And now he and everybody else in my family also have some Piggly Wigglies.
Piggly Wigglies?
So we were
that
among
shows up in family linen.
That's right. We were among the very few people who were not involved in coal mining. But the whole economy is tied entirely to coal mining, really.
As you grew up, were there a lot of books in your house? Did you have a scholarly growing up at all?
No, not at all. Not one bit. I have to say that my dad always liked to recite poetry out loud. So he would recite poetry out loud, and my Uncle Vern would recite poetry out loud and stomp up and down the front porch reading things out loud and so on. But nobody wrote or was an English teacher or anything like that. They were all good storytellers, the women as well as the men. And they were all talking all the time. So I grew up with hearing a lot of stories and hearing a lot of talking. And anything that could be told in a simple answer never was. It was always a big anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is. I mean, that's just sort of the mode of expression.
I guess storytelling is in your genes then.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's just simply the way everybody that I grew up among express themselves, and still does express themselves.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Hollins College in Roanoke, Virginia, which is not so far from Grundy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always wanted to be a writer, but it was when I was at Hollins that I started writing seriously, and I've been writing really seriously now for over 20 years, because I started when I was pretty young. About 18 or 19.
You say you always wanted to be a writer, meaning as a child as well?
Yeah. Uh-huh. When I was a child, I was an only child, and I read a whole lot. And I would still, if you could pay me to do something I would love to do, I would be a reader rather than a writer. I mean, I think the writing is secondary to the reading as far as I'm concerned. So I always read a whole lot, and I wanted to be a writer, but I really never had any sense of appropriate material, I think, until I went to Hollins and took some courses and began to read writers like Eudora Welty, who had the kind of material in a way that I had grown up with, but I didn't realize there was anything worth writing about until I read these other people.
Tell me about your first published work.
Well, I was very lucky. I think my first published work would never be published today. It was a novel I wrote while I was at college, while I was a senior at Highlands, and it was named The Last Day the Dog Bushes Bloomed, and it was a very sort of quiet little novel, I think what they call a quiet little novel, about a child who creates an imaginary world because she can't face the fact that her parents are splitting up. And I was real lucky. It won a national contest that they don't have anymore, that the College English Association and the Book of the Month Club used to run, and then it was subsequently published.
Who was the publisher?
Harper and Row.
Then what happened? You came out with several other books, haven't you?
Yeah. Then I wrote a really forgettable novel, Something in the Wind, which is also a real forgettable title.
Something in the Wind?
Which is a sort of a college novel. And then I wrote, we were living in Alabama. I'd gotten married, and we were living in Alabama by then. And then I wrote a novel I've always liked, although it, like everything else, it kind of sunk into immediate oblivion. But this was a novel named Fancy Strut, and it came out of my newspaper days. And I worked on the newspaper in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and it came directly out of having to cover the Susan Arch Finley Memorial Marching Contest in Alabama, which is the big marching contest, and the interviewing the majorettes and their mothers, particularly their mothers.
Mm.
And it was came and out of watching how a small town will stage a centennial celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It's about that too.
Do you take a semi-autobiographical approach to your work, or do you just make them up?
Really, not at all. Not at all. Actually, I've done a number of things that you would think on the face of it would be interesting, insofar as maybe writing. I went down the Mississippi River on a raft one time, for instance, from Paducah to New Orleans and stuff like that. But I'm just not a bit... I don't know. What I really like to do is make things up. And I'm very bored. I just get ultimately stultifyingly bored by writing autobiographical fiction. I like to read it when other people write it. And I write from the first person a lot of times. But what I'd like to do is make up another person and then write from that person's point of view. And I don't know why that is. It may be just that I wrote nonfiction when I worked on newspapers for so long, that I made a very clear distinction in my head that I've never yet been able to escape from.
Well, you certainly did that in spades, writing from different perspectives in Family Linen, because you write from about this perspective of maybe six, seven, eight different people.
Yeah, I like to do that. I don't know.
Some first person, too.
Yeah. Ann Tyler once was interviewed, and she said something that I really liked. She said somebody asked her why she writes, and she said she writes because she'd like to have more than one life. And I don't know, I've never consciously articulated it like that, but I really do like to do that. I like
That's an interesting
explore
thought.
Different facets. And you know, when you write a book like Family Linen, there's a way in which everybody's finally you, although they're very different, but there'd be some aspect of yourself that's expressed in each character. And a lot of times what's interesting is that it'll be an aspect of yourself that you haven't had a chance to express in your real life.
Mm.
I lead a pretty quiet real life, so I need to write these books.
You had a newspaper career in Tuscaloosa, but then at some point you began teaching, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I've taught for years. I've taught on all kind of levels, from 7th grade in Nashville to high school in Chapel Hill, in a wonderful, innovative sort of Quaker school, to college at several different places. And I'm now on the faculty at North Carolina State University in Raleigh in the English department.
And are you teaching creative writing?
I'm teaching creative writing and also whatever else they need me to teach, various kinds of literature courses and composition courses.
Have you ever lived outside of the South?
No, and I don't think I will.
And you don't plan to?
No, I don't plan to.
Well, a lot of people relocate. I was talking to Bobby Ann Mason about 2 weeks ago, and she's up in Bethlehem.
I know she
or
is.
Or Allentown.
Mertztown.
Well, it's outside of Allentown.
Yeah.
And Gail Godwin, she's up in, oh, gosh, not Tappan, New York. It's above that. I can't remember the name of the town. It's an old French town up there. I can't remember the name of it. But so she relocated. But I don't know. They still haven't. They haven't lost their southern roots and their southern enthusiasms.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Neither one of them has. I don't know. I just can't. Well, I could. I think I would like to maybe, you know, live somewhere else for a year or for a semester or something like that. I think that would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I certainly like to visit other places. But it just seems to me that what strikes me as something I want to write about is usually something close to home. I remember being up here. I remember being in New York this summer and staying in a friend's apartment on 96th Street and Broadway, which was just about three floors up. And
it wasn't Roy Blunt, was it?
Yeah, staying at Roy's.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal and I were out on the balcony looking out, and we just kept seeing all these things. And we saw this one sort of attempted murder where this person was tracking a man with a broken bottle in each hand. And he'd run in and out of this doorway and in there and so on, just like that. And she would track him around. It was wonderful. And I couldn't quit. I couldn't come in and go to bed. And Hal said, well, why don't you, you know, don't you think it'd be good if you would stay somewhere like this for a while and you get a lot of ideas to write about. But I said then, and I still think, that it wouldn't. Because, I mean, it would be entertaining. It was like watching television. But it wasn't anything that I could get enough of a purchase on to write about. And I don't write out of my head entirely. I mean, I need a constant stimulus from daily life. I need to be the kind of person who drives carpools and goes to the grocery store and goes to the PTA and just does sort of normal stuff, because that's the kind of thing I write about. So I think I need to be pretty much where I am.
Still, that's the kind of incident, the stalking incident, that you can apply even if the setting
is
wrong.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are all of your books set in the South?
Yeah, they are.
Tell me about Family Linen. When I first started reading it, at first I thought it was comedy.
Well, it kind of is.
It is, kind of. And, but then there are a lot of serious and very sobering overtones in the book as well. And so I think there was a mixture there. And so it wasn't a consistent comedy, because I thought it was a serious novel as well. Tell me about
it. I intended for it to be, but it's hard, you know, because that's a fine line when you're trying to make it be both.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me how you planned it and what you thought you would achieve as you started working.
Well, I'll tell you, when I had written, the last novel I wrote before Family Linen was a novel named Oral History. And for that novel, I really did a lot of oral history. I've been taping the people where I live, where I grew up, for years, and writing down stuff, going around, just kind of interviewing people and writing down what they say and all this kind of thing. And one thing that struck me, beyond the actual Appalachian legends and folk tales and things that I've been recording, was just the fact of how, when you ask several people who were present at the same incident about it, you get wildly different stories. Whether it's just family members all telling what it used to be like to go to grandmother's on Sunday, or whether it's everybody who was present at a certain killing, or whether it's just whatever. But, I mean, it could be different events. And I've just become very fascinated with the idea that no matter what's being told, the story changes according to the needs of the teller, that it's finally the teller's tale, whatever it is. So I wanted, and it seems to me that nowhere is this more pervasive than in families, you know, where we share our lives with people very closely, but yet each of us is so completely distant in a way from those in our families with whom we should be closest. And so I wanted to get something. I wanted to get some sort of plot. I have trouble with plot. I can make up all these characters, but I have a lot of trouble thinking of anything for them to do. And I had this idea of all these different characters in a family who would talk and be led by something or other to sort of tell their stories and talk about the past, and we would see how it differed and what they each thought of what it had been like. How finally family life is a mystery, and finally the past is a mystery, and you can get ideas about it, but you can't really get at it. So I had all these characters, and I had their various stories, and I couldn't think of a plot. And then I read in the newspaper this case that happened down in Robeson County in North Carolina, where this middle-aged woman went to the doctor because she had these recurrent headaches, and he hypnotized her, and under hypnosis she remembered that she had seen her father kill her mother and cut him up with the axe. And I just didn't find out any more about it at that point because I didn't want to know anything about the real people. But I just thought, okay, why don't I start with that? And I can have this woman going home to confront her mother and the family about this. But then the mother has a stroke, and so she can't be confronted. So everybody just starts talking about the past and thinking about the past, and all these things come dragging up out of the past. And so that's the plot, I guess, and I didn't even think that up. I just got it out of the newspaper, and that's all the plot there is to it, really.
You certainly gave strikingly different characteristics to each of the family members. You know, they're each very vivid and unique. I don't think there's one that is like another, and that's good, because I've sometimes read novels where the characters are they're not as distinct from one another as they should be. And I think it's important to show these contrasts and differences in the characters in a given novel. And you did that,
thank you. As I say, I had such a strong sense of all these characters long before I thought of the novel, long before I thought of any plot that would put them all in one book. Mm-hmm. One thing that has always interested me is the idea of, I guess it's aesthetics, I don't know what you'd call it, the idea of a person functioning as an artist, not in a way that we usually think of an artist functioning. Like, I wrote a story one time named Cakewalk, which was about people that make these ornamental cakes. Mm-hmm. I had been to see the ornamental cake display at the North Carolina State Fair, and there were cakes that were made like Mount St. Helens before eruption and then after eruption, or, you know, just these various wonderful things. And I'd always thought in a small town that a beautician occupies in many ways this role, because she sort of prepares people for all the major rituals that mark the passing of time. And she also acts like a shrink. Everybody tells her everything. And so I wanted to have Candy, I think, is the figure in this book that I had really been thinking of for a long, long time. She's sort of an artist. I mean, she creates the women all the time. She creates the people of the town. She really functions, to my mind, kind of as an artist in a small town. And so I really had Candy very much in mind, and I didn't have a story to put her in for a long time, including the gross part in there. In small towns, the beauticians are the ones that will fix a corpse up, for instance, for death or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you always have a writing project, or you'd like to take a rest between things?
Well, I teach school, and when I'm really teaching, when I'm teaching a full load, which I just about always am, I'm not writing, because I get, you know, you get real involved in your students' work, mm-hmm. particularly if it's any good, and which it always is, it seems to me, or there's always somebody that is, and you just get, I think, you put the same energy into that you put into your own writing. So I will go long periods of time not writing. And I think I'm the kind of writer too. I think, you know, I read in these things like the Paris Review interviews of these people that get up every morning and they write for an hour and a half with a number two pencil standing up, or they do this and that. Mm-hmm. My writing schedule has always been determined by whatever my real job was, number one, and my children's ages, number two. I mean, when my children were real little, I'd write at night because they went to bed early. Now mm-hmm. they're teenagers and they sleep real late, so I get up. I mean, it just depends on what's going on, mm-hmm. sort of. And I do go long periods without writing. And then every now and then, like I got a semester off, thanks to North Carolina State, where I teach to write family women. And I just wrote like crazy. As soon as the kids went to school, I'd write until they came home. I'd write 6 hours a day. Well, so it just kind of depends.
Must be nice having the luxury to sit there and write full time and not have to do anything else.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Except for a woman always has to do other stuff. I mean, you know,
and
I mean, it's
don't?
Not like, you know, I mean, you ain't got a wife, right, who's doing this other stuff.
Men don't have to do other stuff, too?
Well, I guess they do.
Well, they just have to rotate.
I guess they do.
They have to rotate the tires in the car and cut the grass and all that stuff
yeah.
that cuts into their real lives. How many children do you have?
I have two boys.
And,
I have just remarried, and Hal has a daughter, so now I have a stepdaughter as well, and all these kids are 14 and 15 years old. Two 14-year-olds.
That's good and bad.
It's really wonderful, actually, but it keeps you kind of busy.
Yeah, adolescence is not the easiest.
It's the last little bit of busyness, though, before they get their driver's licenses, and we'll never see them again. Everybody's being really nice to us right now because they want cars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure. You live in Raleigh, you said?
Live in Chapel Hill.
Oh, that's right. But you teach in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a commute.
What sort of distance is it?
It's about a 45-minute drive.
Oh, that's not bad.
It's not awful.
I've never been to Chapel Hill. I've been through Raleigh a number of times. It's a very pretty area there.
It's really nice.
What's it like? Do you have culture shock when you leave the South to come to a place like New York?
Well, yes, I really do, actually. I have been to New York. I guess Hal, who's my husband now, comes to New York from time to time, so maybe in the last 2 years I've come more than I had ever come altogether before. And it's once you figure out sort of how to do stuff, it becomes easier, I think. It's not really as hard as I thought it was to get around in New York at first. But there is a, I mean, it's totally different. It's very different.
You usually stay with Roy Blunt?
Have done that. Have stayed with my agent, Liz Dorn's off a couple mm-hmm. of times, or other friends.
How did you get to know Roy?
He used to hang around Nashville.
Well,
he had gone to school there, and then he has good friends there. And so we have some mutual friends in Nashville.
Yeah, I think Roy is coming in next week.
He has a wonderful new book, not exactly what I had in mind.
Yeah, yeah. See, I expect to see him. Matter of fact, I noticed his book, Crackers, has just been remaindered.
Has it?
Yeah.
Well, I can get a whole bunch more then.
You can get a whole bunch more. You go over to Barnes & Noble.
I love those. You know, the little pieces on the relatives.
Yeah.
I just love those.
Yeah. Came out in
1980. Barnes & Noble,
yeah. Just,
right.
They just stacked them in. I haven't read Crackers. I've read his others, but I have not read Crackers, so I happen to see it there. So
it's a little more, the pieces in there, I think, are a little more tied to the time and place, maybe. But I don't know that that's bad or good. It'll make you remember the Carter administration, or that's the effect it has on
you. Who are some of the other people you like to read?
Oh, gee. Well, the two that you mentioned, I really like to read Ann Tyler and Bobby Ann Mason,
mm-hmm.
and I've just read their new books and things. They're wonderful. I really like to read Peter Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished reading A Victory Over Japan by Ellen Gilchrist,
mm-hmm.
which I had not read
mm-hmm.
before. So I like, how do you pronounce it, Andre Dubuque? Just read a book of stories by him.
Mm-hmm.
I like to read fiction a lot.
And you're a partisan to the Southern writers, I see.
Well, not so much. These just seem to be the people I've been reading most recently. But I just, you know, I tend to read, well, like one of my favorite writers is Wright Morris, for instance.
Uh-huh.
It's not, or Margaret Atwood. I mean, there are a lot of writers that are not Southern writers, I think.
Well, Lee Smith, I certainly enjoyed Family Linen, and you were easy to talk to, and I'm glad you got in all right, although a little late, but you got here, and that's the important thing. And I hope New York treats you well for the time you'll be here, and you'll see some other interesting scenes like people stalking each other that you could file away in the back of your mind.
That was amazing.
I live on 97th Street, so
that's... So you're close.
Yeah, that's a colorful, can be a colorful neighborhood.
It's changing. Really colorful.
It's changing, though. It's becoming very expensive, and the old tenement buildings are beginning to be converted to condos and co-ops, and a lot of new restaurants.
Well, you know, it's funny. The first time I came was when that building was just being... Now, I guess it was 3 years ago or 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then Helen and I were here again last summer, and it's much more chic. I mean, there are lots of restaurants along that weren't, you know, and so on. It has changed.
There was a huge Mexican restaurant on the ground floor of that building, though. I can't remember.
It's
multi-level. It's just opened within the last 6 months or so. And
I didn't even know that.
It's a multi-leveled Mexican restaurant that packs in something like 500 people, I understand.
Oh,
it's huge. Now, I haven't even been there, but I read about it all the time because it's a very in place.
An in place to go.
How long will you be in New York?
Just until tomorrow.
Well, you're going to have a whirlwind visit.
I am.
Then where do you go?
Home.
Oh, you just came in? Just going to fly in and fly out.
Yeah, I'm going to give a reading tonight. I wish I didn't have this cold. I'm going to give a reading tonight at the Three Lives bookstore.
Yeah. Down in the village. No, you sound fine.
Good.
Your voice sounds fine.
Good.
I would not know that you have a cold at all.
Terrific.
Lee Smith, thank you very much. I really appreciate
you coming
in.
Thank you.
Hang on one second.